In Parshas Miketz, when Yosef has demanded that the brothers bring down Binyamin to Mitzrayim, Yaakov is reluctant, Yaakov doesn't want to send him, he's nervous about him. So Yehuda says, when he attempts to persuade Yaakov to send him down, he says, Shulchan Ariti v'nakum v'nelecha, send the young man with us and we'll go, we'll take care of the business and it'll be great. And he says, Anochi ervenu miyadi tivakshenu, I will pledge him, guarantee him, ervenu, aleph ayin, resh beis nun vav, the language of Arev or Arvus, I will guarantee him, I'll pledge for him, miyadi tivakshenu, I'll be responsible for him, you can seek him from me. If I don't bring him to you, and if I don't bring him to you and produce him unharmed before you, then I will have sinned before you forever. And then we find another reference to this idea of Arvus, this idea that Yehuda had pledged for Binyamin in next week's parasha, in Parshas Vayigash, when the catastrophe occurs and Yosef actually has seized Binyamin and wants to hold on to him. So Yehuda and the brothers are desperately trying to convince Yosef to let him go. So Yehuda, when he explains to Yosef why he's so concerned, why he personally, some of Farshim say, was so involved here, why he was the leader of the brothers, he writes, he told Yosef, Ki avdecha orav esanar, I, your servant, orav esanar, I pledged for that young man, Mim avi lemar, I told my father, lo avienu lelech, lo avi kol hayom, I told my father, if I don't bring him to you, then I will have sinned forever, so let me stay instead of him. So Yehuda was saying that I gave my word, I pledged for him, I guaranteed him, and now I have to make sure that he comes back, whatever it takes, I'll stay instead of him, but it's my responsibility. I have to do whatever it takes to make sure that Binyamin comes back unharmed. Now, the Gemara in Bava Basra on Kufayin Gimel, the Gemara is discussing the halachic idea of an arev, of arvus. Arev in the halachic framework means a guarantor, a co-signer, common on loans. For example, I just saw in the community they were advertising a new free loan gemach where the requirement was stated as two co-signers. Banks do it sometimes. Co-signing is an age-old method where a lender wants to guarantee getting his money back. If he doesn't trust sufficiently the borrower, either because he doesn't have enough resources or because he's not trustworthy, so the lender will often insist on having someone else co-sign, someone who is more reliable, or just having multiple people is better than one person, or people who are more reliable, better credit, better assets. So this is a Talmudic topic too. The Gemara talks about the idea of an arev, of someone who guarantees a loan, and what his halachas are, when he's liable, etc. So in the course of the Gemara actually brings these biblical verses as one of the possible sources for the halachic framework of arev. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Huna, minayin la'arev d'mishtabed, what is the biblical source, what is the daraisa source for the idea that an arev is liable in halacha? Just because he puts his name down, who said that's enough to be chayev? So the Gemara says, "Dichsiv anochi ervenu miyadi tivakshenu," because of what Yehuda said, I pledge him, I guarantee him. This was an unusual kind of arvus. This was for a person. This wasn't money, but still, the basic idea of arvus is referenced in this pasuk. The Gemara says this is actually not classic arvus. Maskevlar of chista hakablanusu. There is another form of arvus called kablanus, which is a stronger form of arvus. Regular arvus is the money flows between the lender and the borrower, and the arev is standing on the side and watching and putting his name down on the paper. That's called arvus. There's something called kablanus, where the money actually passes through the hands of the kablan. The bank gives it to him, and he passes it on to the lova. Since the money went through his hands, he has heightened liability. That's called kablanus. That's a separate category of arvus. So the Gemara says, since Binyamin was given into the care of Yehuda, he has heightened responsibilities. So the Gemara goes on and brings other psukim in Mishlei for the regular idea of arvus. The Gemara winds up producing verses in Mishlei. He says, Lokach bigdo ki arav zar, a person can lose his proverbial shirt, so to speak, because in Mishlei the Torah is warning you against indiscriminately pledging arvus. You think it won't happen. It will happen. You're going to be on the hook. Don't put your name down too quickly, etc., etc. Bni maraptel reecha. If you've given arvus, you're in trouble. And they're going to come after you, etc. So the Gemara says it's an idea of arvus, and that is a halachic, again, a halachic paradigm. It's derived both from the psukim in Miketz and Vayigash, as well as from other psukim in Mishlei. Now, when you learn the Talmudic discussion, so the classic idea of arvus is, like we said, the idea of a cosigner to a lender, for a bank or for a private lender. And that's not something we run into every day. That's a fairly specific, narrow set of circumstances. What I want to discuss today is a much broader, much more powerful application of the idea of arvus to a variety of scenarios that actually can arise much more frequently, that we probably encounter on a much wider basis. That is an extension of arvus to the things I named in the title, the reliance damages and promissory estoppel. It sounds like a mouthful, very, very technical and esoteric terms, but it's actually one of these cases where it's language only a lawyer could love. But the language actually refers to a very intuitive concept that I think we all probably understand and live with and kind of expect intuitively that it makes sense. That is the idea. If I make you some kind of promise, I say I'll do this for you. We'll have a deal, a partnership. I'll go here, and this is my part of the bargain. This is your part of the bargain. So you do what you're supposed to do, and I don't come through. I leave you hanging. So you wind up having spent wasted time and money, but especially money. You wasted money based on a promise on my part, and you wind up having damages because I didn't come through. So that's called reliance damages. You were damaged because you relied on me. You relied on me and you spent money and I didn't fulfill my commitment, and you therefore wound up having damages. That's reliance damages, promissory estoppel. That one of the remedies the court will have is that if you made a promise which you aren't keeping. So I don't know the exact translation of estoppel, but the court will, as a remedy for the person you injured by promising and failing to live up to your promise, the court will find you liable to pay the other party to make him whole from the damages that you caused him.
What's the difference between this and a contract?
So it's a good question. There are a few differences, both in halacha and the law. We're going to focus more on halacha. One difference in halacha is going to be that even in the absence of an explicit contract, even if you didn't explicitly promise that if I don't do, we'll discuss concrete examples soon, but even if I didn't explicitly promise I will pay you if I don't do it, the mere fact that you said you would do it and he took you seriously, even in the absence of any explicit contract, can make you chayav, and we'll see other applications. That's a good question. We'll see other. There is going to be a certain overlap with the laws of contract, but it's basically an extension of contract. Even without an explicit contract, you can be chayav anyway because he relied on you and he suffered a loss because of that. So this is a major principle in halacha. It comes up in a variety of cases involving employees and partners and buyers and sellers. All cases where there are two parties to an arrangement, and one of them acts based on the promises of another, and the other doesn't live up to it, that he can be chayav. And we'll discuss the framework, some of the parameters of this halacha in our discussion today. So some of it begins from a Gemara in Bava Metzia, a different Gemara. Gemara talks about a case. There was a business deal. There was an investor, and there was a kind of manager or an agent. The investor wanted to buy wine from a certain place where wine was available fairly cheaply. He knew if you go to such and such a place and during such and such a period, you can buy wine at a good price. So he told the agent, you take my money, here's cash, here's, he gave him cash, or he didn't give him cash, let's say he even gave him the cash, he took $10,000 and he said, here's the money, take this suitcase full of cash, go to the city was called Zulshafat. Go to the city, buy wine, bring it back, and here, you know, we can sell it at a good profit, so I'll pay you whatever I'll pay you, a percentage or a fixed fee for your efforts, I'll pay you for your work, and you buy this wine, and I'll sell it at a profit, and we'll all be happy. So the agent took the money, agreed to do it. Now, they didn't have, you know, phones, they couldn't text him every day and find out what are you up to, but time passed, and eventually it turned out that the agent did not do it. And the window closed. The wine was only available for a week or so at this price, so that at the favorable terms, he missed the opportunity deliberately. He just decided he had other things to do. He didn't do his job, and so he has the cash. He didn't embezzle the money. The money's going back to the investor, but the investor is getting back his cash, and he lost the opportunity to make a handsome profit on the wine. So the Gemara discusses the question of whether the agent is going to be held liable for the lost opportunity, for the lost profit that the investor suffered. So the answer actually is no, he's not chayev. And that's the halacha in the Gemara, he's not chayev. Even mezer. Even if he's mezer, he's not chayev.
Why is he not chayev?
So the Gemara asks that question. The Gemara asks, why is he not chayev? And the Gemara has a few questions about why. One of the questions is, the Gemara compares it to another case. There's a case in the Gemara where a sharecropper, we had the sharecropping system in the South, they had sharecroppers in the time of the Talmud, where somebody would own a field, he would have a sharecropper who would work the field for him, And they had a profit sharing arrangement. The sharecropper would get a certain percentage of the crop, and the owner would get another percentage of the crop. So it happened one year, the sharecropper didn't do his job. I don't know why the owner didn't notice. He lived far away. Whatever the reason was, the owner didn't notice that the sharecropper was not doing his job, was letting the field sit empty, fallow. So at the end of the year, when it was too late to do anything about it, the owner said, what did you do? You let the field go empty. So the Mishnah says, the sharecropper actually is chayev. He owes the owner whatever the expectation. We have to make an estimate of what the owner's share would have been. He's chayev to the owner for the lost profit, for the lost revenue he would have had for that year. So the Gemara says, why is this different from the case of the wine? So the Gemara says, addressing Moshe's question, the Gemara's conclusion is, why are you potter in the case of the wine? The answer is, for one specific reason. You're potter in the case of the wine because it was not guaranteed, it was not certain that the agent, the shliach, would have been able to do his job. Wine wasn't always available, it was an iffy thing to begin with. They were hoping he can get the wine, but it wasn't a slam dunk. It wasn't a routine matter. There was no guarantee it would have worked. So in such a case where we don't know in hindsight whether he really could have gotten it or not, even had he tried his best, we're not going to hold him responsible. But in any case, the Gemara seems to say, in any case like the case of the sharecropper, where it's pretty much fields. Also, occasionally something goes wrong, but fields apparently is a more reliable, more routine thing. You put your seeds in, then they grow. So most years, if you work, it'll work out okay. In the field case, and similarly in the case of the wine, if the business deal would have been one such that there's no real doubt, or there was nothing up in the air about it, it was a straightforward thing that anybody could have seen, they would have made money, then the agent is going to be chayev for the lost opportunity, for the lost profit of the boss. He might not be able to find the wine. The wine wasn't always available. At the place where he was supposed to buy the wine, they didn't always have wine available. They wouldn't always sell it. Sometimes it wasn't enough. Or it wasn't so easy to find this deal.
So does it teach me, if I want a solid investment, I have to do it myself. I don't have to do that.
Right. That's, I guess, one lesson you could learn, that if you want to be sure and get something done, then right, to do it yourself. Otherwise, you'll have to go to court to Din Torah and see if you can win, according to the sugyas we're going to learn today. Yeah, that's a fair point, and I know. That's
so how can they possibly know?
Look at the next field. Look at the adjacent field.
It's a good point. On the one hand, you can argue it's somewhat regular. On the other hand, Sid is right that some years the water is better. Some years animals come. The Gemara talks about there are plagues. There's weather. I don't know. I don't know enough about farming to know, to give you like a number how. What's the confidence interval? Within how many standard deviations are you likely to get? Right. Yeah. So I can't really answer that question with absolute confidence. But apparently, the Gemara feels the regularity is enough. That you can be chayev. While in the case of the wine, it's not consistent enough. That it's not guaranteed enough that you're not chayev. So there is a Ritva, and the Ritva speaks directly to Adrian's point before. The Ritva brings different opinions of early scholars about how exactly to understand what the chiyuv is. In the case of the wine, if not for the fact that the wine wasn't a sure thing, if not for the fact that it wasn't guaranteed, you'd be chayev for the lost opportunity of the principal, of the investor. So why is that? So he brings both theories. He says some Rishonim learned that it was a form of contract, that the investor had specifically stipulated in his deal with the agent that you are on the hook. If you don't do this, you are going to be chayev for all the expected profit. It's a simple contract. And he signed, he agreed, made a kinyan, whatever it was, that they have a proper contract holding him chayev for any potential shortfall. The Ritva himself says he doesn't agree. He doesn't think you need a contractual obligation here. He thinks even without an explicit contract, you're chayev anyway. And the theory he develops, which is the one we're focusing on today, is the idea of reliance damages. He says the owner has $10,000. He has an opportunity to do a business deal. He says he's relying on you, the agent. He could have done it himself. He could have found another agent. He could have made other arrangements to get this done. He's relying on the agent to get this done. He's committing himself to the agent. He's foregoing other options and other opportunities. He's locking his capital in, reserving it for this arrangement, and the agent doesn't do it. Therefore, the Ritva says, halacha, the Ritva, this is a major foundational Ritva. The Acharonim quote it widely all over Chosh and Mishpat. The halacha, there is no explicit Gemara. As we said, the Gemara talks about, the Gemara in Bava Basra talks about Arvus in the sense of co-signing. But the Ritva says, this is an extension of Arev, an extension of the idea of Arvus, Anochi Erevenu, that even if you don't sign an explicit contract, if you promise to engage in a certain course of action on behalf of somebody else, and he's paying you, and he's relying on you, then you are just going to be chayev, or just like that, you're automatically chayev for any missed opportunities, for any opportunity cost even, that the investor had. The Ritva says, Zed didn't gadol. This is a major foundation of halacha. This is, and that's the doctrine that the Ritva invents based on this Gemara.
Wouldn't it be like an extension of a Shomer Sachar?
Yes, it is a form of Shomer.
Because it's getting the money.
It is a form of Shomer Sachar. The reason, as you said, it's an extension, the reason it's not a straightforward application of it is because in a normal case of Shomer, we discussed a couple of weeks ago, Pashas Vayetze, in a normal course of Shomer, the actual property that you were entrusted with is lost. So here, for example, he gave him $10,000 in cash. Had that money been lost, that would be an issue of Shomer. Here, all the money was returned. The $10,000 is returned intact. He lost the chance to make more money, the opportunity.
Right. That part he lost.
Yeah, so in economics, we can look at that just as a kind of extension of the original money. Money grows naturally. But in halacha, legally, we look at that differently. Legally, we say that's not the actual money you were given. That's more money. And yeah, that's what the Ritva is saying. At the end of the day, he is sort of saying that as a paid employee, you do have such a responsibility. So at the end of the day, he is saying that it sort of falls into the category of Shomer, but it's a chiddush because it's not the actual money, it's an extension.
So if the thieves steal all the money from him, is it still chayav to pay?
But if the thieves you steal, he'd be chayav probably according to everyone because, as you were saying, he's a Shomer Sachar, and a Shomer Sachar is chayav if thieves take the money. That's probably less controversial. That's probably accepted according to everyone. The chiddush here is even beyond the money, even the future money, the money that you expected to make, even that money you can be chayav for. Because and here it's only here it's because you're responsible, you're negligent, you're mazed, and that's why you're chayv.
The businessman has no obligation in this. Suppose he decided to do that with 10 agents, but he knows that there's not enough wine out there for the ball to be successful.
Right. So Sid is raising the question. If the guy knows that sometimes the agents don't go through, so he makes redundant agents, he has overlapping agents who he doesn't really want to do, he hires 10 agents to do it. He doesn't really want all 10, not to be enough wine for all 10, he doesn't have enough money for all 10. He just knows that not all of them will work, so he has multiple redundant efforts. Right, so that's an interesting question. In such a case where he didn't really expect, he wanted to know if they're all going to be chayav separately. If they all don't do it, whether he can collect from each one of them, or if not, how many are you going to have to pay? Do they split the cost in such a case? Yeah, you're right. You're not liable in the specific case for another reason, because it was considered not in their hands. But the principle the Ritva is saying is something that is in your hands. We're going to discuss many other cases today where things are considered, they are biyado, they are considered in his hands. In those cases, you're actually chayav. That's what the Ritva says. That if you find a case where it is biyado, where it is considered in your hands, then you're chayav. He wants to know, in a case like that, where it is in your hands, but you appointed multiple ones, are they all going to be chayav, or only some of them, or... Yes, that I'm not exactly sure about. So the Ritva says you don't have to have shtar. The Ritva says even without shtar, that's part of his chiddush, no kinyan, no shtar, no agreement, no explicit agreement, nothing. The simple fact that you promised, and he accepted the promise, and it was a serious promise, and he relied on it, even though there was no talk about payment or compensation or anything, the mere fact that he promised and he took it seriously and you acted, that's chayav, the Ritva says. So just to discuss a few examples of cases where the poskim rule this way, in cases like this, one of the cases is called Lech Vani Avo Acharecha. Literally, that means go and I'll follow you, go and I'll meet you. Basically, two guys set up a meeting. They said, we need to have a business meeting. I'm in New York, you're in California. Let's meet tomorrow afternoon. We'll meet in Silver Spring. So we'll book a conference room, and I'll fly down there, and you'll fly down there, and we'll meet tomorrow afternoon. So one of them goes through and comes down there and buys the plane ticket and travels and rents the car or whatever he has to do. The other one doesn't show up. Says, sorry, I had something else I wanted to take care of instead. Should have given you a call. Okay, sorry, got busy. So the poskim say the Lavush, the Ramah in this case, the Rishonim, they say that you are chayev. They say even though you never stipulated if you don't come, you will be chayev for all the costs of my travel time. It doesn't matter. As long as, again, the rule is as long as people have a commitment to each other and each party acts and spends money based on the fact there was a commitment from the other party and that the expenses were expected, that each party understood that if we're going to meet in a third, if we're going to meet in a third location, each one understands the other one has expenses. So each one knows that when he makes his promise that he expects the other one to act on it, and the other one does act on it, and he knows the other one will have expenses, the other one does have expenses. In all these cases, halacha, similar to the law, does have the notion, according to the Ramah in this case, that there is a chiyuv for any cost that he incurred because he relied on you and acted on you, acted on a promise that you made and he didn't fulfill. No, but the other guy did. That I promised to show up, and I know that you promised to show up, and each one of us knows that the other one's going to have costs.
When you were saying it over, you said each person's money.
Yeah, that's true, right. And in the case of one of them showed up, he didn't have costs, right. That I was not speaking precisely. I meant that each one in advance expects the other one to have expenses, and therefore if one of them does and one of them doesn't, then the one of them doesn't live up to his part side of the bargain, he's going to be liable to the other one for causing him to spend money and not living up to his promise, which the other guy relied on.
The difference between this and the wine is that in the case of the wine, there's no certainty about the deal.
Right.
In this case, there was certainty right. that they had to meet.
Yeah, there was certainty to meet. There was nothing that was contingent on third parties. Right, exactly. There was nothing that was anything else, and therefore chayav.
Chayav to pay for the half of the schedule for this. The other guy went to work and made money. This guy was sitting in the lobby waiting for him.
Well, in the case I just said, it would be the cost of the ticket. If they had a meeting and each side was going to have $200 of traveling expenses, the one guy didn't show up, he has to pay the $200 of the other guy's expenses.
Time?
The time
is a good question. Probably not the time. The time is a good question. We will discuss soon the case. Let's discuss that now. There's another case, which is major, which we'll discuss now time in a minute. And right now, there's a major debate among the poskim. This is a very common question. Let's say you hire a worker. You tell a worker that I have a job for you. It's going to be 8 hours of work. You're an electrician, whatever it is. It's going to be 8 hours of work. I'll pay you at $150 an hour, whatever it is. And you know, so you're going to have $1,200, $1,200 worth of work from 9 to 5 tomorrow morning. Tomorrow. So tomorrow morning comes, the electrician shows up, and you say, oh, sorry, I changed my mind, I made a mistake, I don't need the work done, I don't want to do it, I'm doing something else with the property, I don't need it, sorry, have a good day. So do you owe the worker anything? So it depends, of course, it depends on various factors. One of the key factors is whether the worker gave up other opportunities to work because he relied on you, and now it's too late to go back to those other jobs. So in a case where he had no other job anyway, and now he has no job, he's not worse off than he was before, all right. In a case where he still can get other jobs, you can just pick up the phone and call the other guy and say, okay, it looks like I'm free today, I'll come down and do your job. All right, then you didn't cause him any damage. But in a case where both conditions are met, where yesterday he still had other job opportunities, when he originally committed to you, he still had other job opportunities which he turned down. Now, by the time you tell him that you don't have the job for him, it's too late for those other jobs. Now he has no job. So you cost him the difference between having a job and not having a job. You cost him the difference between $1,200 of income. So the poskim say, the Shulchan Aruch says, the Rishonim say, you are chayev to pay him for the lost income that your fault that he doesn't have. Now, you don't pay him, the halach is you don't pay him the full amount, because you can say you have the day off. The day off is worth something. I mean, you'd like to have $1,200, but $1,200 is worth working. Now it's $1,200 worth having free time to do whatever you want, to spend time with your kids or whatever it is. So you subtract something. We're not going to get into the details of how you calculate right now, but basically you do have to pay him for the lost income with an adjustment for the fact that he has vacation. So why do you pay this money? What is the halachic rationale? It makes sense. Intuitively, it makes a lot of sense. It's your fault. You promised him, and it's your fault again. But how do we understand the legal halachic rationale, the halachic rationale for this type of obligation? So one model, again, proposed by the same Ritva, one model is it's a form of arvus. It's a form of reliance damages. He relied on you to give up an opportunity, the opportunity to accept other jobs. He relied on you. You committed to him. You didn't follow through on your commitment. Those jobs, again, they were biyado. There was no doubt. There was nothing speculative about them. He had other jobs lined up. Because he relied on you, he gave up those other opportunities. So just like in the case of the wine and the ritva, in the Gemara, if he gave up the chance, the investor gave up the chance, assuming that it was biyado, assuming that we're not dealing with the specific case of the Gemara where it was out of his control. In a case where the investment would have been a routine and sure thing, like the farming is considered sure enough to be chayev. In a case where he gave up a relatively sure thing because of your commitment and you didn't follow through, the ritva says that you're chayev again because of reliance damages. Because arvus, anochi arvenu, he relied on you. You committed to him, you didn't follow through, and you are chayev.
For the case of electrician, you're talking Jew and Jew?
I'm talking Jew and Jew is the common case discussed in the halacha. Whether the halacha will be different for non-Jew or not, I have to think about. So sometimes the halacha is different, sometimes it's not different. I would have to sit down and think whether there's any difference between Jew and not Jew in this area. There might be certain differences, but yeah, mainly we're talking about Jew and Jew right now.
And you can come to agreement somehow.
Come to?
Agreement. You know, to bargain with him or...
Bargain with him? You mean ask him if he'll take... You're definitely allowed to negotiate, to ask him if he'll take less. You cannot threaten to do shalom kedin. You can't say, I won't pay you anything unless you agree. If according to the halakha, you're chayiv, you can't just tell him, tough, we're not going
to
pay you. But you can tell him, look, you know, I understand you lost money, but you know, I had a reason or whatever, and I didn't mean to hurt you. And you're allowed to ask. You're allowed to ask for a deal. Yeah, you're allowed to say, will you accept a smaller number? Yes, you're allowed to ask. You can't threaten to not pay him at all, but you're allowed to ask if you can negotiate a different number. Yes. A neder? No. Neder is an important idea, and the neder sometimes becomes a factor. To be a neder, you really need one of two things. You either need special language that indicates neder, like you would have to have said the word vow or neder or shvua or oath or something like that, or if the purpose that you're promising money for is a mitzvah, then sometimes it becomes a neder. If you say, for example, if you told a poor person, whether it's a question of tzedakah involved maybe, that you'll give him work, then maybe we might become a neder in certain cases. But generally, a financial transaction between two Jews does not have the status of a neder. Now, it was common in certain parts of the Jewish, in certain Jewish communities, particularly among the Sfardim, it was common that they would often back up their financial contracts by making an explicit shvua. They would write, I hereby take a vow. If a person borrowed money, he would say, I make a kinyan to pay you back. I take a vow to pay back on time. Now, and that would often be a real shvua, and there are many very serious discussions in the Sfaradic poskim. Even if you find, let's say, loopholes or suffix or other reasons why, in terms of the regular din Torah, you might win, but a neder is very serious, and maybe you have to be extra stringent, then that's a topic of a great discussion. But that only applies if you deliberately and explicitly put in language that invokes the language of neder. An ordinary business contract doesn't have the status of a neder. So, and especially in the case that we're talking about today, where there was no explicit promise to pay anything, you just said, I will do this, I'll give you the job, and now the job is not here. So the ritva says again that because of the principle of reliance damages, he relied on you and committed himself and gave up something else, then you're going to be chayev. You're going to be chayev under the principle of reliance damages.
On the other side of the coin, also, right? If the guy doesn't show up for the job that they both agreed, he would be liable, also.
So Adrian's asking, what about the reverse case? What if the worker doesn't show up, and for some reason the employer has some loss? So that case actually is discussed in the postcum too. They talk about cases where the employer has something which is a time-sensitive job, which has to be done, or he's going to suffer a loss. That some industrial process that if the worker doesn't come on time, things are going to spoil, or things are going to get damaged, and he's going to have a loss. You can think of a lot of cases. He won't get a thing to market on time, or whatever it is. You can obviously think of a lot of cases where, if the worker doesn't show up, he'll be costing the owner certainly opportunity costs and even actual cost out of pocket. So yes, there too, there is a halacha that the worker in some cases will be held liable. It's complicated again, exactly when, exactly under what circumstances, but yes, according to the rule we're saying today, insofar as Post can accept this rule that even without any real contract or anything, the mere fact that you promised and he relied on you and you don't show up, that you're going to be chayav, then yes, that would be another reason. That would be another reason to be chayav for the worker not doing his job, based on the idea of reliance damages. He relies. It works in both directions. Yes, if either party relies on the other party, that's very similar to the agent case. The agent is sort of the worker for the investor. If he doesn't do his job, then he's gonna be chayav. He brings. It's a similar case, just to deal with Adrian's question. The Nesivos talks about a similar case where somebody hires, let's say, a carpenter or an artisan of some sort to build a piece of furniture, for example. So let's say the customer supplies the raw material, the wood. He tells him that you build me a chair with these specifications and I'll pay you whatever I'll pay you. Actually, let's move to a slightly different case. The example of the case of the worker that Stevens is talking about is a person. Second. Yeah, so I'm not going to get into all the exact cases for the moment. I have to clear up my notes a little bit. But basically, yes, the Nesivos HaMishpat is one of the key achronim who works with this system of the Ritva. And he does say workers too, workers who are hired and relied on by their owners, and the owner relies on them for their business plan to preserve their capital and make profits, then yes, he will be chayav for not living up to his side of the bargain, even though he has no explicit contract, no explicit kinyan that obligates him to pay in the event where things don't go as planned. Yes, the either side will be chayav to the other side for not living up to his side of the bargain because the other side relied on them. That's the same idea, yes.
Now, there's a difference. There is a commitment of payments from one side at the beginning. So there is no commitment of payment from the side of the worker, even though it doesn't show. There was never a commitment of payments. Right?
That's true.
On the other side, there was a commitment of payment from the beginning.
That's true,
so
but
it's not symmetrical.
That's true. It's not totally symmetrical, but nevertheless, the Achronim who go with this approach do say that it works in both directions. That either party who doesn't, where there is payment, there's no payment, like the case of the business meeting where nobody agreed to pay anybody anything. In all these cases, you're right, we could conceptually distinguish, but in all these cases, Post can say there is basis to be chayav based on this principle of reliance.
Well, did they have the idea back then that a third party, namely an insurance company, could pick up the liability of one party?
So insurance is discussed in Post can going back about 500 years, and from the time of the 16th century, particularly among the Sephardim, where they did a lot of merchandise, shipping merchandise around the Mediterranean, over land routes, caravan routes, and on sea routes of ships, where there was always a relatively high risk of danger, shipwrecks and piracy, right? Piracy and so on, bandits on land and so on. There is a lot of discussion about insurance. They did have insurance. They often had insurance. They weren't, you know, like today, big. They weren't. The common situation wasn't like today. We have big companies doing insurance. Insurance was typically an individual contract underwritten by a specific investor. Sometimes it would be a contract written by the shipper himself. Where it would write some kind of contract guaranteeing against certain types of loss. Sometimes it would be a third party who would issue a contract. And yes, they did have it. That it wasn't, you know, as routine as it was today with standard companies and standard policies, but they did have insurance contracts. One of my favorite tshuvos in the Achronim, I mean, it's a kind of morbid case, but one of my favorite discussions is there was a merchant who sent merchandise via ship. The crew of the ship mutinied. They murdered, I think, the officers, and they ran off with the merchandise. So the investor, who was safe on land, he turned to the insurer and said, "You insured the cargo, so pay me for the cargo." So the insurer said, "I insured you against piracy. This is not piracy, this is mutiny." So the customer said, "It's piracy. Piracy means people by force carry off the goods." The insurer said, "No, piracy means they come from another ship with the flag and everything and they steal your goods. This was mutiny. That's different." That was a contract case, deciding how to interpret the language. You have to see what the contract said. But yeah, they did have insurance back then.
What if the circumstances beyond the employer's control? For example, the employer says, "I have a house. I want you to paint it. on Wednesday and Tuesday the house burns to the ground?
Yes, that's an excellent question. So when it comes to the context of employment, the halacha is explicit that if what we call an onus, what you said, out of his control, happens to the employer, he is not liable for the, even though the employee suffers a loss, he's not liable. The examples the Talmud gives are, you hire a worker to irrigate your field and then it rains the night before, you don't need it, or you hire a worker to irrigate by drawing water from the river and the river dries up, so there is no river, so you can't do it. Neither of these types of cases where the onus is you don't need it, or the onus is that it can't be done, or very, in general, the rule is that an employer, without an express stipulation, unless you have a contract that holds you liable, either written or it could be verbal also possibly, but unless you have an explicit arrangement that you're chayev, the employer is generally going to be off the hook. And similarly, in some of the other cases we've been discussing, for example, the case of the business meeting where they both agreed that they would meet at a common place and one of them got stuck, there was a road closure or something, or the train derailment, and he can't get through. So we actually have a machlokas in this case. The Yeshuas Yisrael brings the Knesset Gdolah, who says that even if he's an onus, you have to pay. At the end of the day, you're responsible no matter what. And he says, what does that mean? Tema, how can that be? He says, onus according to Patre. The rule always is, throughout Halacha, throughout Chosh Mishpa, throughout other areas of Halacha, the Torah never holds you responsible for something that's not your fault. So I think that's a normative position, that in most of these cases, you will not be held liable if it's not your fault. Now again, how much fault does it have to be is an important question, but in principle, I think the consensus would be, not your fault, you're not going to be chayav.
You said the shetar goes for both ways, right? The contractor and the employee.
The what?
The shetar goes for both ways, right? So I did not ask if the other guy doesn't show. You see what I mean?
Right. In the standard case, if either guy doesn't show, it's a problem, and either guy might be chayav according to this idea. Not, you know, again, there are other shitas and other opinions, but at least according to the approach we're discussing here, it would work both ways. Either party could be chayav to the other party for not doing what he promised to do. Yes.
It's not complicated. For case of discussion, for this electrician, you told me I give you $1,200 all day work for you, and I come to you at I am the electrician at 8 o'clock. And he said, no, I don't want you to work for me. And okay, we come agreement, you give me $200 and I go.
Right.
All of a sudden somebody calls me and say, okay, Moshe, come do the job for me, I give you $2,000.
Right. So
I'm here making money more because of
right.
you.
So Moshe wants to know what happens if the electrician gets a different job. Is he still entitled to whatever money he's being paid by the first guy? So the basic rule would be in such cases is that you normally cannot charge the chatchila, you cannot charge the owner for anything that you can make up somewhere else. You make up even more, then you don't charge him anything. You make up the same amount, you don't charge him anything. You make less, you can charge him the difference. If the original job would have been $1,200 and the new job, the same level of difficulty, the same hours, it only gives you $800, you would get $400. In a case where you already made a deal and he already promised you and you negotiated and he already took... You shook hands on 200, he gave you the money, and then you get another job somewhere else. That's a good question. My not 100% sure. I think the halakha would have to be that you would give it back in such a case. That the understanding is the deal is only if you don't have another job, but if you do, my understanding is you would have to revisit it, but I'd have to think about it. I'm not 100% sure. I think you would give it back. Unless it was clear that was not the intention, unless it was clear this is final regardless of what happens going forward, but I mean, by default, I think you would give it back.
All these things are, I know the definition of things, like the insurance cases, what's piracy, I'll meet you at this place or that place, and it's like, they went to the wrong hotel. All these legal things depend on very precise definitions
So that's fair. A lot of areas in halacha are going to depend on the details. Yes, the details, if they're not clear, they're not clear. If you have to, that's what basin has to do. The very, very.
That's what you need a basin.
That's what you need a basin. And again,
you can prevent a basin if you have in the contract a whole page of definition.
Oh, absolutely. And we encourage that. Well, we tell people all the time that you can avoid many arguments later if you're as clear as you can up front. Doesn't help for everything, but.
The piracy thing. That happened like recently, a year or two ago, in a kashrut case over here in Potomac, where one company sold the rights to catering to another company, and it got down to the definition of catering. So
right.
One store was a party would call in and say, I want to come and buy $200 worth of bagels because I'm going to take this, buy it in your store, and take it to my home and put on a party. The person that bought the rights to catering says, that's catering.
Yeah, so
it's not catering because we didn't deliver it to them. They
right.
came and bought it from us.
Contract
lawsuit based on this whether it's catering.
Contractual interpretation is a major area of halacha as well as law, and it's important. Yeah, the only point, all I can say, you're right. It's absolutely going to be a question, and no matter how much you put in writing, there's always going to be some case that doesn't fit into the. But at the end of the day, the point I would just make is that the first thing you have to do is kind of understand the conceptual rules, and after that, you then have to understand the language of the contract. And once you if you start with the foundation, then you can, when you try to apply it to specific cases, you're going to have to then understand what the words mean. That's very important. I'm not denying that. And that's kind of infinite. You can always, no matter how much you put in writing, there's always going to be some new case. No matter how much.
The parasha, why Yehuda agreed to that? Maybe he couldn't rescue Benjamin. Why he?
So what he was actually agreeing to is not clear. We find in Parshas Vayigash he was agreeing to go down and trade himself for Binyamin. Well, what if Yosef would have said no? Like Yosef said, I'm not, no deal, you can't do that. He would have been stuck. It's at that point, that brings us back to the Gemara of Matzia. Something is not biyado. Some things are not in your control. So right. So I don't have that much discussion about that. About had they gone to a Din Torah, Yehuda and Yaakov, do you have to do this? Don't you have to do this? You know, what would it actually have been binding in the case of the Torah, where again it wasn't money, it was life and death, it was people. I don't really know how to apply the halakha to the actual deal in the parasha itself, but yeah, you're right. How to apply all these rules back to the case of Yaakov and Yehuda is not a simple matter. I agree.
When you started out with your premise was that the owner was asking for somebody to work X number of hours to do something. So basically, anytime you deal with a craftsman, he knows the subject, and you're just basically guessing. So I need some electrical work, but I have no way really of knowing whether it's 8 hours or 14 hours.
That's true.
So the 12 hours was sort of a guess. I mean, is there any basis for it?
Yeah, so I was dealing with kind of simple cases where you're dealing with work that was actually you committed for a number of hours, more like a babysitter, I guess, or like a other types of work. I have a sister who does graphic design, so she does freelance work. So she tried. She used to go back and forth on billing either by the job or by the hour. So right. She found, I think, that she tended to make more money when she billed by the job because she worked faster than the standard expectation. If the standard expectation would be a job like this, the mechanics have their standard rates. Replacing brakes is a 2-hour job, whatever it is, or 1-hour job. She found that her work was typically faster, so she'd wind up getting more money if she billed by the job than if she billed by the actual hour. Yes, you're right. A worker has the right to bill based on either system, whatever is in line with industry norms. And right, applying these halakhas for how much you're going to charge for in a case where it's uncertain or unclear how many hours it would have been, obviously that's an additional complication. Right? We're just kind of discussing the conceptually simplest cases where there's no doubt about the hours involved, but you're right, it'll be more complicated if you don't know how many hours it would have been.
But the purchaser has to know up front, I think, what the deal is. She has to inform the purchaser she's billing by the job. And
yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
She's just billing it.
No. I'm right. I should have said that clearly. No, it was a question of how should she structure the deal originally with the client. Should she make the proposal in terms of I'll charge you for this project $1,000, or should she say I'll charge you $50 an hour or whatever it is for the project? Yes, absolutely. So just to discuss quickly one or two other cases where the poskim debate these things. One of the very common questions was somebody, a buyer agreed to buy merchandise from a seller, and they said, we'll take delivery of 100 barrels of oil, let's say, at this and this location, at this and this time. So the seller agrees to produce it at that location, the buyer agrees to take delivery, and one of them doesn't follow through. So let's say the seller doesn't come there with his oil at the right time, so the buyer hired wagons, he hired transportation, and now he's out the cost of his transportation. Or the reverse case, the seller paid for the wagons to bring all his stuff down to the drop-off point, and the buyer doesn't show up. So one of the parties, so Rebbe Meir had a question like this, and Sivas and others discussed questions like this. Can the party, again, there was no contract that said that if you don't, it was an informal deal, there was nothing that was said specifically about holding you responsible if you don't show up with your goods or with your wagons. But practically each side knows that when you order 100 barrels of oil, there's going to be a cost in getting transportation. So again, Poskim invoke the same idea, reliance damages. Each party relies on the other one to fulfill his part of the deal. And if he doesn't, then he's going to have a, if he doesn't, he's going to have a tviya. Whatever the expected costs were, he's going to be able to charge the other one. Again, not all Poskim agree. We're discussing one important theory, although not without controversy. Some Poskim accept, based on this ritva, the halacha has this notion of reliance damages, that you're going to be held chayev for any expected cost. Assuming it was your fault, that you didn't live up to your side of the deal, you're going to be chayev. One last case we'll discuss is the tshuva of the rush. Somebody told the butcher in those days, he owned the animals and he shechted them, let's say. He told the butcher, I need some meat. Please shecht your cow and I'll buy kosher meat at the rate of $10 a pound. The butcher said, wait a second, but if I shecht this cow, maybe it'll be a trefa cow, maybe it'll turn out to be a trefa. And then I don't have a handy non-Jew to dispose of it to, so I'm going to suffer a loss. We have to sell it at a big loss. The buyer said, no problem, I'll agree to pay you a minimum guaranteed rate, even if it's treif. I'll cover that. So the butcher shechted the animal. Turned out it was taka treif, unfortunately. The buyer walked off. He said, I'm not paying you anything. The seller said, you promised. The buyer said, sorry, promise, not enforceable. Promise, like, it's not a neder, like we said before. A promise is, maybe it's not nice, but a promise is not enforceable. And unless you can produce some kind of kinyan, some kind of binding contract, a simple verbal commitment is not going to be binding in halach. So that's what the rush ruled. The rush ruled is not a nice thing to do, maybe, but it's not enforceable in court. It's not enforceable in Beis Din because you don't have a proper contract. So the Beis Yosef asked, why do you need a contract? You have the doctrine of arvus, and that anytime somebody relies on somebody else to commit himself based on somebody's promise, that itself triggers a kinyan, even without any formal contract, without any kinyan. The mere fact that somebody relies on you and takes action that could be detrimental to his own interests based on a commitment from you, that's arvus. So the Poskim struggle to explain what the reason is. The details are beyond the scope of our talk today, but that's another example of the Poskim debate why the principle of arvus does not apply.